The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we are going to talk about new IRA proposals that are featured in the 2017 Congressional Budget Proposal. That sounds dry as heck for a show. The point is, there might be some changes coming to your IRAs and the rules that control those IRAs, so it's important to keep these topics on the radar, if you will. Top of the mind, so that you're not surprised by them, and think about how these things might affect your planning for your own retirement, your future. So these are items in the 2017 Congressional Budget Proposal. For those of you unaware of how the budgeting process works in the United States, at the federal level, the president has a proposed budget that they put forth, and the Congress puts forth a budget, and then they kind of negotiate it around, and eventually, if things work, which they don't always, as we've seen in the past, there will be some agreement reached on an official budget, and that will become law at that point. So this is in the Congressional Budget Proposal. We have talked about some of the things featured in the presidential budget proposal in the past.
Some of which have seen the light of day.
Some of which, over the years, we've talked about this for quite some time, because guess what? Every year this comes out. And sometimes you'll see things proposed for a number of years and they don't actually end up being included in the final budget, but then eventually they do end up sticking. So we've seen that in the past with some of these things in particular that affect retirement plans, which is and taxes of those retirement plans, and that's why we keep it on our radar. So we thought we'd go over some of those things today. Welcome, Jim. Jim's here with us, and Pete's here too, yeah. Peter Scott. So, which is a little sad because we're not doing estate planning topics.
Sorry, I'll just
Pete's
I'll
here,
just...
but Pete.
Well,
Pete's,
he knows Pete's a tax, he knows all about this
a tax guy as
he
well.
Is.
So, yeah. Some of these budget items have taxation effects, and he can help fill in some of the nuances. I guess
they usually always have tax impact because they're about raising revenue.
And all of these proposals, except for one, and there's six that affect IRAs that we're going to talk about, five of them will raise revenue.
Yeah. In the short term. That's always the key.
And short term and probably longer term.
Some are just overall tax implications overall, but sometimes they, for those of you who pay attention to things like IRAs and hopefully listening to this show for a while, you'll get more into the nuances of IRAs. Now I've said nuances two or three times on the show, which is kind of odd for me.
Can't use that word anymore.
What's the word you always use that Remember there was somebody who proposed
yes.
the drinking
and I was
game?
Listening to us the other day.
And you said it all
and
the time.
And I said it all the time.
Yeah.
Begins with an A.
Yeah.
What was the word?
I don't know. It'll come. You'll say
I'm
it.
I'm sure I'll say
you'll
it
say
again.
It pretty soon and then it'll come to me.
It begins with an A. How many words begin with an A?
Uh-huh.
Just a couple.
Yeah, just a couple. What was the point?
Allude.
Allude, yeah.
That's what
alluded
I say.
Alluded to what you alluded to.
Alluded
that's,
to, yeah. yes.
Yeah, after someone else speaks, that's how he begins every rebuttal.
I'm pretty bad at that because someone pointed that out to us in an email.
We should knock it off.
Drinking game.
No, they wanted us to do a drinking game where we had to drink something every time.
Every time I said allude.
And I'd be in the bathroom
vomiting
for half the show.
You'd be so drunk.
You're assuming alcoholic beverages, but just the sheer amount of liquid intake would be enough.
So I will not say allude. You don't say
whatever.
You don't say this
nuance.
Nuance.
I hardly say nuance in my life, so we'll see. There's got to be some kind of punishment here.
Well, what about Pete? He's got to say something.
I'm not going to say anything.
He never repeats the same two words twice.
How is you have 3 weeks left before you retire. I mean, are you excited?
Well,
and are you ready? Did you plan for this retirement?
No. I'll be working.
I know you were in the office today helping more clients of mine. So.
Yes, exactly. So I can't say no is the problem. But my official date to ride off into the sunset, which will be probably for a couple days only, is going to be April 15th. I've got so much cleanup to do.
Oh, so you've postponed it to April now?
Yeah.
Tax day.
Yeah. Well, that's in conjunction with my wife, who is going to be working tax season. So.
Oh, it wouldn't be fair for you to retire, and she wasn't finished yet. So that's very noble of you.
Yes, it is, of course. Which I hope she's listening. In fact, I'll make sure
encourage
the radio's on Saturday. I'll make sure she listens at least this part. But, yeah, I've got so much cleanup to do that I'm going to really disappear but still be in the office trying to get things cleaned up.
Well, I do appreciate the time you give coming on the show. I know Chris appreciates us too, and our listeners do. And the good news is, listeners, Pete's not going to fully go.
Well, someday he will.
Someday, yes, to the great place in the sky, the great estate plan in the sky. But Pete will come in, make special guest appearances, and help educate listeners. Speaking of which, our Texas listener calls himself Lone Star Texas George.
I thought it was just Lone Star George. It's Lone Star Texas George?
Lone Star.
Long.
I'll see.
I like Lone Star George.
Well, Lone Star Texas is a bit of a redundancy.
True. Well, I'll tell you what he calls himself.
Could be Lone Star State George. That'd be even worse.
Let me open his email. Hold on.
Let's all pause the radio show.
Yeah,
well, you guys keep talking. I'm looking
for...
What I was
alluding to...
see?
I can say it. You can't. What I was alluding to before this strange segue... IRAs are a form of a tax deferral vehicle, so there are tax implications in the future for the distributions that come out of those accounts. So Uncle Sam hasn't gotten their money. When you put money into a tax-deferred account, the whole point is you've deferred paying taxes. So what I meant by it will increase taxes in the short term is if they take away the ability to defer taxes for various reasons, that means they're going to collect them sooner than later. So that tax bill that you were putting off to the future might come due sooner than later. And that's what I was alluding to. I'm going to mock him with my ability to say
alluding. Lone Star George.
Perfect.
No Texas.
Exactly.
Lone Star George.
Well, I like him better already.
Yep.
The problem is, Lone Star, I know you're probably listening.
Now we're on a first name basis.
Well, that would be Lone.
We're not going to answer your question today.
Oh, see, now he's going to stop listening.
But Pete has promised to come back. And the reason is, I asked him a series of questions in the morning. He did get back to me. But he attached some documents. As Pete was looking through the documents, he wanted to read through them. And we decided to actually, as you said, Chris, not just answer, because he's got a lot going on. And I think you both agree.
Yeah.
And the way both of you ramble on and on and on and on and on, his email could go several shows left unchecked.
If you are discussing it, yes.
But what we're going to do is break it. Pete is going to spend a show talking about some of the estate implications of what he's written. And then on another show, Chris, you and I are going to address the conversion and some other issues that we wanted to bring up. But much to your strong recommendation, we're not going to answer his questions just specifically to him, but we'll try to make it generalized because not many listeners will be in his situation. I think we both agree on that.
I wish more were.
Yes.
Because that would be a good thing for people.
It would be.
He has some challenges.
He
questions,
is, absolutely.
But they're good kind of challenges to have and good kind of questions to
absolutely.
Be answered.
Absolutely. So it'll probably be two shows now, Lone Star, and one that will look at the estate implications that Pete will get into, and the other will look at more of the numbers and the finances and strategies of converting and not converting and Social Security and Medicare and life insurance and all these things that he needs to probably be considering, and I'm not sure if he is.
Well, I think one thing that will become apparent with his case that does align with people more generally that may not be in such a strong financial position as this as Mr. Starr is the fact that one of your largest expenses in retirement are taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these things people talk about, but not enough attention is paid to taxes. Because coordinating the timing of certain events can actually make a difference in your tax bill. And the less you pay in taxes, the more you can spend on fun things to do in retirement.
And I want to add, and I'm sure you will agree, Pete, being an estate planning attorney, it's not just in retirement where taxes are going to be a major expense. It's at death.
Well, it's at death and then following death when the children or spouse or whoever.
That's what I'm talking about, yes. That at the passing of your assets, after you pass away, your assets go to someone else. And there's tax implications there. And it's not just estate taxes.
Right.
And although in Lone Star George's situation, estate taxes aren't an issue now, you and I, Pete and Chris, you agree, estate taxes may become an issue for him in the future that we think his estate will be larger than the estate tax exemption. But it's also income taxes.
Right.
And people don't factor income taxes in. So there's a lot of moving parts here. We're going to get to it. I know I've been talking for a while on that, but we have the date actually chosen because, Pete, you are going to come in and record on January 3rd, this case, I think
yes.
we decided?
Yep.
Okay, so whatever Saturday is after January 3rd, what is that? That would be January 7th?
4 days later.
7th, yes.
I did the math, 7th. All right. Mm-hmm. And that'll be the day it'll play, Lone Star. So assuming there's no problems, that everything goes as planned, we promptly answered his original email that came in on September 22nd on
September.
January 3rd. Mm-hmm. Not saying we're fast, but we're going to be thorough.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So for
today. Good thing he's relatively young still. That's all I'll say.
He's 56, okay? His wife is 51, so they got time. But a lot of moving parts here. I think people are going to enjoy the show because they're going to learn a lot about estate planning. And then
this one or the one on the 7th?
The one on the 7th.
Oh.
We're not talking
what
estate
about this
planning
one?
Today. No,
yeah,
we're not going to
enjoy
anything.
This
no.
show.
You guys are going to be bored. No. There'll be plenty to talk about.
I sure wish I could put another star on the map.
Well, you can put a lone star.
It's already lone starred up right there.
No, we don't have any stars. Sorry. No.
No new stars.
No new stars. Emails have been scant.
Really?
That's why we're doing a show that doesn't include answering an email question. Unless, do you want to answer the Social Security email question you just answered? Do you think that's interesting enough to...
Oh, I think it is, actually.
Okay.
For people who listen to the radio show but don't follow our blog post, they may have missed it.
Okay.
So how about if I just tackle that during the fourth segment when we talk about Social Security?
Okay, we'll do it then.
Okay.
So today's show, though, folks, we are going to talk about IRA proposals. And there's one reason I wanted Pete here, because even though it's not about estate planning, IRAs do tie into estate planning. And many of these proposals, Pete, you and I have talked about professionally and socially because we think they're coming.
Right, and socially it was really a lot more fun.
I was going to say, in what social event are taxes being discussed?
We went out to dinner.
Can you tell how dull our lives are?
When he and I are together, we talk this. This is what we talk. We don't talk about fishing, hunting, or women, the three things that pretty much drive my life. But
well, two more than the third.
Excuse me?
Pardon? Maybe it's because in a social settings you're speaking of taxes. That might be a hint
as to the challenges
involved.
Okay, yeah. So now you got me all thinking about other things.
Well,
all right.
Hopefully I'm not offending some unknown
admirer
or relationship that you're engaged in to which you've not
shared us any details. Let's share with people who may be listening to this show, a certain person in particular. Chris does not know my particular social life.
The status of the relationship with said person who's listening to the show.
Correct.
Oh, well, we'll be interested to find out about that in the second segment.
Okay, so back to these proposals. These proposals have appeared on this show in the past, and they've appeared in presidential budgets and congressional budgets. As Chris was saying, they mostly, I call these lead balloons. They kind of float these out there to see how they're going to be received, but also I think to prep people that they're coming. And we know one thing is going to happen. Actually, a lot is going to happen after Trump gets sworn in. And we don't know if it's going to be for the better or for the worse. It's going to be very entertaining 4 years. I don't think anyone will dispute that. We're going to have the first presidential Twitter fights, I think. But there are going to be major tax changes. The Republicans have made that perfectly clear. It will not surprise me out of the six proposals in the congressional budget, the 2017 congressional budget. It wouldn't surprise me if at least three of these see the light of day. Wouldn't surprise me at all. And some of them will. And they're going to impact planning, just like the Social Security changes that happened this year after being passed pretty much a year ago and taken effect on April 29th of this year. We have seen, Chris, people already impacted by it.
Yes, negatively.
Negatively. And we're going to see changes here. Now, Chris did point out, folks, because he whined a little, that he never got to see these ahead of time. And I pointed out to him, neither did
Pete.
So
if my utterances seem less informed than usual, it's because these are coming at me blind.
So both Pete and Chris, this is going to be a surprise to them. Apparently, you all don't read the congressional budget when it comes out.
We wait for you to supply it to us.
Yes.
Because we know you're reading it at social events.
Yes, and talking about it. Some pickup lines, contained in the...
Hey, look what I just downloaded.
Want to look at my budget?
Want to look at this policy?
Why don't you come up to my place and we'll look at the budget.
It is pretty sad because I did read one of the PLRs, remember, over the wintertime, and Chris was, you sat home, I read it like three times over the weekend. Mm-hmm. It was 50-something pages. Mm-hmm. And he was, all weekend you sat home and read the, it was the Bobro case. That was a major case.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was.
Yeah.
So I read it.
And a major reason you're single.
Okay, so let's get into some of these proposals. The first one, we have talked about this. Pete, I feel strongly this one is going to see the light of day. Totally eliminate the ability of a non-spouse beneficiary to stretch out an inherited IRA's payments.
I agree.
In other words, come back to the five-year rule, which is the rule that used to be there before 2000.
Yeah, just reverting. It's called a classical IRA.
Reversion to the mean?
Yeah, classical technique.
What do you think, Pete?
I think it's been in the budget so many times that everybody's kind of warming up to it. And they certainly need the money. I mean, there's no question about it. And sooner rather than later, and this accomplishes that.
And the intent, to their defense on this, the intent of these retirement accounts was for people's retirement. It wasn't meant as a vehicle to pass along wealth to following generations. So I can kind of get the fact that it wasn't intended for your descendant to continue to stretch things out and defer taxes for possibly 30 years plus. So
exactly. So let's talk a little bit about what this is. Let's give some background because we'll get through all six of these if I just read them. So let's do a little background here. Right now, folks, what happens when you pass away and a non-spouse beneficiary inherits your IRA? So that, for most people, is generally a child or their favorite radio show host. One of the two.
Or a sibling.
Some
people don't have kids, so usually it goes to a sibling.
Well, that's where the favorite radio show host fits
comes in. Comes in above the sibling?
For this particular radio show host, yes.
Okay.
Got a problem with that?
No, and definitely any IRA you might inherit will be a non-spouse beneficiary situation.
For this particular radio show host, yes.
Likely to remain that way, too.
Yes. So, yes, what are the implications of you inheriting an IRA as the beneficiary?
Well, what happens when a non-spouse beneficiary inherits an IRA under current rules? What the non-spouse beneficiary, let's just say me, would do is I would look at the single life table in the year after I inherit the IRA. So let's just say Pete left me his IRA, which I think would be a fine
thing.
You
are my favorite radio show host.
That's what I thought. And if he left me his IRA and he passed away in 2017, mm-hmm. he was just unfortunate in retirement. And I inherit the IRA. In 2017, I will be 54 years old. The IRS says, first of all, when I inherit the IRA, I must take any required minimum distribution in the year I inherit it if the person who passed away was subject to required minimum distributions and didn't take one. So that's the first thing that the non-spouse beneficiary is going to have to do. So the non-spouse beneficiary may have to take an RMD, may not.
And for clarification to our listeners who might include other financial planners, that RMD gets distributed to the person who inherited the account. It does not go to the estate of the person who passed away. That's an area of immense confusion.
Right. Would
you
agree
with
Pete?
Financial planners? They think that because the RMD was supposed to go to the person who's now passed, that RMD should go into the estate of that person. And it very explicitly describes that distribution is to go to the person who now owns the IRA, which is the beneficiary of that IRA.
Yeah, and I agree with Jim. Very few people are aware of that. But I do have a question. Whose life expectancy is that RMD based on?
The original RMD that was owed.
The decedents, right?
Right. That gets a little deep. Mm-hmm. It depends. If the person who passes away, the non-spouse benefit... Pete, how old are you?
Too old.
he's subject to RMDs.
I am. Almost. Almost.
He's not quite.
Well, in 2017?
No. 2018.
Oh, so okay. Here's well, no RMDs what, for him.
Here's what happens, in case you're wondering. The RMD that was missed...
Required minimum distribution.
The required minimum distribution, if it was required by the decedent, will be the decedent's RMD. So if the decedent was required to remove $20,000 in the year of death but didn't, then $20,000 must come out. So the year of death required minimum distribution is what we call it in the industry. That required minimum distribution is the decedent's required minimum distribution.
The decedent is the dead person, just to clarify.
Yeah, that's what it means. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens when a non-spouse beneficiary inherits it again? Next year, Pete, for some odd reason, decides to disinherit his wife and leave his IRA to me. He passes away, most likely because his wife killed him when she found out he left his IRA to me and not to her. So she knocks him off. I inherit the IRA. Now, we know, because Pete just spilled the beans, he is not subject to required minimum distributions next year. So I would not have to take anything out in the year of Pete's death, 2017. But beginning in 2018, the year after Pete's death, I will have to begin taking required minimum distributions, even though I am not 70 and a half. Next year, 2017, I'm only 54. It's far away from 70 and a half. But because I am a non-spouse beneficiary, I must begin required minimum distributions. It doesn't matter if I was 24, 14, or 4. No matter your age, if you're a non-spouse beneficiary, you have to take required minimum distributions. So next year, Pete passes away. He is not 70 and a half. No required minimum distribution. I inherit it. I'll explain to you when you come back how this is going to be factored in, how it's figured out, and why they're going to get rid of this rule. That's what this whole show is about. This proposal has been in President Obama's budget and the congressional budget, and the Supreme Court, Pete, I think you would agree, in 2015 pretty much put the nail in the coffin on the stretch.
Yep.
And it's because of the Supreme Court ruling, and we'll get into that when we come back. You're going to see this go away.
Yep. So that music means we're at our first break here. And when we come back from our first break, we're going to take a listen to one of the top most popular songs from 80 years ago in 1935. I guess 81 years ago at this point. So from 1935, the year that Social Security was started, we're going to hear one of the many top songs. There were quite a few. But we'll be back with you right after the short break on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Believe it or not, that was one of the most popular songs of 1935.
Yeah, Red Sails in the Sunset, right?
Yeah.
Wow, how did you know that?
It feels a bit depressing to me.
Yeah. I just happened to know that stuff. Of course, you know, I danced to it when I was in my younger years and when it was popular.
When it was a hot, brand new song?
Yeah, exactly. When it first came out.
So that version was from Guy Lombardo.
Ooh.
Many people have recorded Red Sails in the Sunset over the years, but that was Guy Lombardo from 1935 as they were all celebrating the beginning of Social Security, which had just gone into effect in August of 1935.
Guy Lombardo and his Royal Mounties, I think, was his band, wasn't it?
It was eventually. I don't think he'd hired the Mounties yet.
Oh, okay. But they played on horseback, as
Guy Lombardo did connect with the Mounties. Uh-huh. And there were some other, the Royal Canadian Mounties. I think it was Guy Lombardo and the,
maybe it
was a long version. Uh-huh. I'll look that up for you as Jim is opining about something.
No, I'm just listening to you.
Maybe you can share with us what you were alluding to before the break.
You can keep. I haven't said that word yet.
Not yet.
It's coming. I'll go the whole show.
Okay, we'll see.
Now you're going to try to
trick
me.
I'll stop reminding you of it by saying it, and then we'll see how long it goes.
Okay, so back to what we were saying. We were talking about IRA proposals. In the 2017 congressional budget proposal. But these have been in the president's budget proposal and the congressional budget proposal for years. And I feel strongly, in my opinion, at least three of these will probably see the light of day in the massive tax changes that are coming our way after Trump gets sworn in. Paul Ryan, when he was interviewed just this week on 60 Minutes, again made it clear that major tax changes are coming our way. So the first one we were talking about is the abolishment of the stretch IRA, and that is for non-spouse beneficiaries. So this has nothing to do with a husband and a wife or a husband and a husband or wife and a wife. Whoever is leaving an asset to a spouse, it doesn't apply to you. It applies to when the last spouse passes away or someone such as myself who is single wants to leave his or her IRA to someone. Obviously, if we're single or a widow or a widower, we don't have a spouse. What happens to the IRA at that point? Under current law, you can stretch it out, and that's where we left off. We gave the hypothetical that Pete, for some odd reason, decided to name me as beneficiary of his IRA. In anger, his lovely wife, Mrs. Pete, found out and killed him.
Completely justifiable.
That's why she wasn't convicted.
Right.
So now I inherit Pete's IRA next year, and Pete is not age 70 and a half, so he had no required minimum distributions. So in the year of death, I would not have to take anything out. If Pete was 70 and a half and had a required minimum distribution, I would have to remove what Pete was supposed to have removed but didn't before his wife did him in. Now, what happens to the IRA? Beginning in the year after I inherit it, I have to begin required minimum distributions. My deadline is December 31st of the year after the year of death. So if Pete died in 2017, I would be 54 years old. Required minimum distributions for me would begin by December 31st of 2018. And in 2018, folks, I will be 55. So even though I inherited it at 54, when required minimum distributions begin December 31st of the year following the year of death, I will be 55. So I go to the single life table and look at the number on the single life table written next to 55. That is 29.6. That's the IRS's best guess estimate of how long a 55-year-old in America will live, 29.6 years. So what I am going to then be forced to do is take Pete's IRA, all $1.95 of it that he left me.
Yep.
So you're giving me the whole IRA.
All $1.95, yeah.
So I would take that. Let's just say instead of $1.95, let's just say it was $195,000, Chris. I would take $195,000 and divide it by 29.6. What does that come to?
$6,588, which is about 3.38% of his total.
So I would have to take out whatever Chris just said. I wasn't paying attention.
$6,588.
About $6,500 I take out. The following year, I look at the December 31st value, and the $195,000 IRA either grew or fell for the year, but I would divide it, not by 29.6, folks, by 28.6, and then the following year, 27.6, and 26.6, and 25.6. In short, the single life table, which is a table provided by the IRS, it's called the Single Life Table for Inherited IRAs. That's probably the most perfect name the government ever came up with for something because it really says what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Single Life Table for Inherited IRAs. You can just Google that, and the government provides that to everyone. My inherited IRA from Pete would last 29.6 years.
So if you survive that by some miracle, it would be exhausted by the time you hit, what, 85, 86, somewhere.
Which
in
is right around, it's right between, because a male is expected to lift 85, a female 87. So the point, people, is this IRA can stay open for 29.6 years because you just find your divisor, subtract one every year, and that's your RMD. Under the proposal, they want to force non-spouse beneficiaries to just close the IRA within 5 years. Now, from simplicity's sake, Pete, I think you'd agree, that's a hell of a lot easier.
Sure.
I mean, this other one is very difficult to figure out. Not very difficult when you know how to do it. But for someone who doesn't know what they're doing, it can be daunting to figure it out. And then remember where the hell you are in this divisor subtracting. What's my new divisor? You got to write this down somewhere. Because
yep.
You might be 15, 18, 19 years into this, and you're like, oh, God, what is my divisor this year? I think it began at 29-something. I don't know. And then you're trying to figure out what the divisor is. We in the office in our client files write. We don't write. Everything's electronic now. Type where we left off in the divisor from the previous year so we can keep track of it. But that's probably one of the biggest things is remembering where you are in subtracting one from something. It mm-hmm. sounds real easy, but you tend to forget things over the 365 days in a year. And as you get older, you tend to forget things even quicker. So the government simply wants to abolish this stretch because they want me to take the $195,000 that I inherited from Pete and take it out much quicker. So if I had the five-year rule and I wanted to do 20% a year and I inherited $195,000, what do I got to take out, Chris?
$195,000?
About $38,000,
$39,000. $39,000,
exactly. Oh, pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I would have to take out $39,000, not $6,500, because I got to close the IRA within 5 years. So I could do 20% a year, or I could do 0000 and all of it.
And as a reminder, those monies that come out you must pay taxes on it. And that's why the government, Congress in this case, is wanting it sooner than later, because they're going to receive that tax revenue into the Treasury more rapidly.
But not only more rapidly, faster, it's also going to be possibly pushing me into a higher tax bracket.
Exactly.
Because what if Pete's IRA wasn't $195,000? What if it was $600,000? And he left it to his son or his daughter, not his favorite radio show host slash friend who really likes him.
With the stretch, she's only,
and we'll miss him immensely when he's gone.
I can see that crocodile tear coming down.
With the stretch, you'd only have to take out about $20,000
from a $600,000 IRA,
right? Which you might stay kind of within your current marginal tax bracket, but within 5 years, you're going to be taking out $120,000 minimum in any given year.
Exactly.
You know, you could do it spread out, or you could do all 600,000 in 1 year. That's, you're definitely going to find yourself in a very unappealing tax bracket using that.
But even at 120,000, it would push me as a single person. If I was in the 15 bracket, it would definitely push me into the 25. If I was in the 25, it would probably push me into the 31. So it can push you into a higher bracket. And that, folks, is why they're doing it. It's going to get the money out quicker and at a higher tax rate. That's why people need to pay attention when they start trying to figure out if they should convert or not. Actually, I'm getting off. I'm not going to go down that road.
Well, we always talk about how an IRA is actually a fairly unappealing thing to leave to someone as a beneficiary. There's other assets that are much more appealing. So when this leads us into the timing of distributions, when we take money from what account. And it might make sense, especially if this rule is enacted, even more so, that you drain things like an IRA prior to other assets being liquidated for use in retirement, because those other assets might be treated much more favorably from a tax standpoint than the IRA is when your favorite radio host or your son or daughter or someone else receives it.
Absolutely. And do you have anything to add to that, Pete?
Well, I think the attractiveness of non-qualified, non-IRA assets is that there's a step up in basis at death, so the capital gain goes away. With IRAs, other retirement accounts, there is no step up in basis. And in addition to that, 100% is going to be income taxable to the recipient. So, yes, I agree that there are other more attractive assets. That's why very often we recommend, if someone's charitably inclined, the retirement asset is really prime funding for a retirement, or rather a charitable gift or contribution. So you're right. I think there are other assets that are much more attractive.
Now, I did also say, and I want to throw in real quickly before the last break, that we can thank the Supreme Court for bringing a lot of this to the forefront. I think if the Supreme Court didn't rule what they did in 2015, it still would have seen the light of day. But I think the Supreme Court's ruling only makes it more of a certainty. And what they ruled, folks, is that an inherited IRA is not a retirement account.
For you, the person,
for the
who,
person
inherited,
who inherited it.
It's a retirement account for the
decedent.
Decedent.
But once that person dies and leaves the IRA to someone else, it's not a retirement account in the eyes of the Supreme Court, a very famous ruling. And it opened that IRA to bankruptcy and creditors. So now that we have the Supreme Court saying an inherited IRA is not a retirement account, Congress is saying, why, as Chris was talking about, why should we afford it? All these tax benefits then. Mm-hmm. So I really think this one is going to happen.
I think so too.
And you need to prep for it. Lone Star George, we're going to be talking about this when we answer your question in a couple of weeks. Because of the sheer size of his IRAs today in his 50s, I'm not only looking to the situation he's going to be when RMDs begin for him at 70 and a half. I asked him if he has kids. He does. I'm looking at the major tax burden those kids are going to have, because I know this five-year rule is coming in, and they're doing it to force these very large IRAs that Lone Star George and others are going to have, these very large IRAs to be closed in a very short period of time, forcing them into the highest marginal bracket possible, and giving the government more taxes. And they have the ability to hide if their constituents complain behind a Supreme Court ruling that it's not a retirement account.
And the Supreme Court reached that ruling primarily as rationale for saying that an inherited IRA, as Chris mentioned, is not afforded the same exemption from creditors that a earned retirement for the wage earner. And so that's how they got around to it. But I agree with you. That knocked the legs out of the argument against the
Absolutely.
Repeal.
And if memory serves me correct, that Supreme Court ruling was unanimous.
They all agreed, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Unanimous.
No.
I'd stop saying it.
It's not unanimous?
Nope.
No.
Son of a... Can you please
We've practiced
it?
This before.
Unanimous.
Unanimous.
And what did you say is... They all agreed.
They all agreed.
They all agreed.
Yeah.
Much better.
They all voted and voted the same way.
Yeah. They all broded in unison. They all voted
they
in unison.
They broded in unison.
I don't know.
Chris, I don't know if you caught
if you caught it earlier, but Jim was talking about floating a lead balloon. And
yeah, I got that. I didn't say it.
Okay,
yeah.
You were very
I let that one go. I know.
That's a saying. Mm. Floating a lead balloon doesn't float.
No, you're gonna float a balloon. You put it up there and let people look at it and see how they like it. That's what that is referring to. Well, you could also say it floats like, or it sinks like a lead balloon.
Or it went over like a lead balloon.
So once again, you've combined two sayings into one of your own creation.
But that's the efficiency that Jim works with.
Maybe it's so, yeah.
It's not floating a lead balloon?
Not in the usage.
Common usage.
Not in the way you used it.
Okay.
Thanks, Pete, for catching. You know, I was gonna let that one go. Yeah, but you're right. We really needed to address that one.
I'm glad we did. I feel better now.
Yeah. You and I are unanimous in that decision.
You know, I want to say something else, but this is a public radio station, so I won't.
Well, I can beep it out in post production.
You may have to. All right, number two. Mm-hmm. I do not think this one will see the light of day, at least coming from this Congress. But it is in the congressional budget proposal, so it made me go, It is definitely in President Obama. Now, he won't be here, but it was in his budget for several years. It has wide, wide support from the Democrats. They call it, and I love the euphemisms they give, they call it IRA equalization. Who could be against that?
Well, those who...
Someone being equalized.
Yes, someone who is the victim of this...
Because it sounds harmonious. I
very much agree.
check his coffin.
IRA equalization is also being touted as IRA simplification.
Oh, even a better...
In other words... To either equalize or simplify the rules. And since traditional IRAs have required minimum distributions and Roths don't, in the eyes of certain people in government, let's impose required minimum distributions on Roth IRAs so it will be unified and simplified and equalized. So the rules won't confuse people anymore. I'm just telling
that's
you.
That's my vote right there.
They're floating this like a lead. That's how you would use it.
It's going over like a lead balloon.
That's how. See? Yeah. That's what I said.
Yep. Sure. Mm-hmm.
So what they want to do allegedly is simplify the rules by saying it's too confusing. IRAs have required minimum distributions. Roth IRAs don't. Now, notice that
people who are confused can certainly take RMDs from their Roth. There's no... There's nothing preventing you from doing so.
But
so let me be clear.
If we were to take the government's rationale here, couldn't the same argument simply be made? Well, IRAs have required minimum distributions. Roths don't. So let's just get rid of required minimum distributions. There's the equalization.
Yep.
Thank you.
Our in-studio audience appreciates that.
That sounds good.
But folks, what they're proposing is... giving or requiring required minimum distributions from Roth IRAs. I don't think this will see the light of day in this Congress. I think the first one will. I don't think this one will.
Because that one isn't really an attack on or a revenue generation thing. It's an attack on people leaving money to their kids, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's an attack on the transfer of wealth.
Yeah.
But it also could create taxes in the sense, none of this will be taxed. Although if you don't take a required minimum distribution from a Roth IRA, you will be subject to a 50% penalty tax on something that would have been 100% tax-free. That said, I think what they're looking for, Chris, is force you to take money out. You're either going to spend it or invest it. And both of those should help the economy.
Right.
So this is being touted also. Not only simple, I love the simplification argument.
Yeah.
Not only are they making things simple by just keeping the rules the same, of course, never dawning on them to just get rid of RMDs, and that would keep the rules the same and simplify matters. But they're also touting it as a way to get economic growth because that money now would either be spent or invested. I would argue, well, it's already invested. So you're taking it from one investment, moving it to another investment.
Right.
That's not going to help anything. So what they're hoping for, though, is it will be invested where? In an account subject to taxes because it's no longer in a Roth IRA. So that investment will generate taxes to the government, whereas it doesn't inside the Roth. And yes, it may be spent. If people end up having to take out $20,000 from a Roth IRA, chances are they're going to spend it or some of it. So even though that's in there, I don't think it'll see the light of day.
And your listeners sure are aware that Roth IRAs for the owner of the account don't have required minimum distributions currently, and they're not taxable when they take it out. When it passes to another generation, then
a non-spouse beneficiary will have, that's very good, Pete, will have required minimum distributions.
But there's still no tax
income
to the government because those distributions are still tax-free. They're just forced to drain them so that the... I guess the way it stands now, there is some wealth transfer for one generation, but it can't go again to the next generation. And that's, if we look historically at estate tax issues, that's actually a lot of what they were trying to prevent with estate taxes, is that not have this wealth be built up and then passed through three, four, five generations, getting larger and larger and just concentrating this wealth in the hands of very few.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So Roth... at least got you right now to one generation to your kids, but can't go to the grandkids if they were second in line. It could have gone to them directly, but there's none of this second, third, fourth step where it's still amassed in this account and isn't being forced to be distributed.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. The third proposal affecting IRAs in the 2017 congressional budget. I think we could see this. I think we could see this in this Congress as well. Although I'm on the fence on this one. Eliminate backdoor Roth IRAs. It is in the president's proposal. I was surprised to see it in the government's the congressional proposal. I could see it. I mean, I think if I had to choose yay and nay, I would say I could see this passing. What do you, and then we'll explain what we're talking about. What do you think, Pete?
I think it would be passing it if they can get the IRA equalization. I think, and of course the first one I agree is very, very likely. I think they might concede on this one, so they've got at least something to politically position, say, well, we didn't pass them all. And the back door really, I was surprised to actually see that it was being made available. It just seemed to be a little...
It is truly a... There's some things that are accused of being a loophole when I would say it. I'm not sure that was a loophole. That was obvious that that was going to happen with the law. And so, in my eyes, that makes it intentionally allowed. But this one is pretty much a loophole because they fully intended for people of... adjusted gross income above certain limits to be barred from contributing to a Roth.
Right.
So any technique that bypasses that rule, which is the backdoor Roth contribution, is a loophole. It's getting past the intent because they very specifically bar someone above certain income limits from contributing to a Roth. So the fact that they can find a way to still get money in there is a loophole.
Well,
so I bet this one gets closed. If they were able to get through these soft loopholes, if you will, what they accused some of these Social Security techniques or strategies of being last year, and those passed, and they called them loopholes. I'm not sure those were really loopholes. I think they were obviously available for people when the law was originally passed back in the 80s, right? Isn't that when the file and suspend strategy was essentially allowed? But they called them loopholes and got them closed. This one is an obvious loophole in my mind. So, but well, we can talk about that some more.
We'll describe what
the backdoor Roth contribution is. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear one of the top songs, actually the top song from... No, it's just one of the top songs, because the top song this week in 1976 is still Rod Stewart, Tonight's the Night. We're not going to hear that one. We're going to hear a song that's the first single created by a band named for a U.S. city.
Chicago.
So we'll find out. Wrong. We'll find out what that is after this short break.
Wrong.
Wrong.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is the number, well, it isn't the number one song from this week in 1976 as we look back 40 years. This is one of the singles in the top 10 that particular week. But since Rod Stewart is monopolizing the number one position with Tonight's the Night, we instead decided to mix it up a little bit, play this song, which is the first single from this band with... the band being named for a U.S. city. It isn't the first single from any band named after a U.S. city.
Because we agreed Chicago would have been named somewhere in the
60s. Probably one before that. But anyway, definitely Chicago beat them. So I apologize for misspeaking in the prior segment with the hint. This is the first single from Boston. Don't think it hit number one at any point. But it did make it in the top 10. So their first single did pretty darn well.
Yeah.
And they had some future hits.
From that same album. Then they kind of went downhill. They came up with one more album. And then really they've gone nowhere.
They didn't have the staying power of Chicago. That's
no, they
sure.
did not.
No, Chicago had, I don't know, 20 albums, maybe more.
Yeah.
Probably should have stopped after 14 or so. But just my personal opinion. Being a huge Chicago fan.
I like Chicago. I saw them at Red Rocks a few years ago.
Mm. Yeah, I saw them live a long time ago. They were quite good. So where were we? Oh, this is the Retirement and IRA Show. We're talking about some of the proposals that may affect IRAs that are in the 2017 Congressional Budget Proposal.
We were left off with the IRA.
The backdoor Roth contribution.
You know, that my view on that is that it was strictly a revenue-raising approach and making it attractive for people to convert and, of course, pay the tax on their IRAs on conversion. I viewed it as one of those short-term revenue raising.
They did. So the roots of this came back in 2010 when the rule for converting to a Roth changed. Prior to that, if you made more than $100,000, you were barred from converting.
Single or married.
Correct. So the threshold was fairly low. And there were a lot of people with traditional IRAs that were simply barred from contributing to or I'm sorry, converting into a Roth. In 2010, that changed. They didn't just raise the limit. They removed it completely. So people of any income are allowed to convert 401ks, traditional IRAs, these pre-tax accounts that they might have into Roth IRAs, thus paying the tax. Mm-hmm. So that's where you're talking about it's a tax generation situation.
Yeah, because they didn't allow them to contribute mm-hmm. to a Roth. Mm-hmm. They only allowed them to convert, which generated income
right.
tax.
But what they didn't do is close the back door.
Right.
And the back door is that they maintained the restriction on direct contributions.
Right, right.
And in 2016 here, for a married couple, if you make over $191,000, I think is the upper $194,000, so I was close. So $194,000 as a married couple filing jointly, you are barred from contributing a dime into your Roth IRA. However, the backdoor situation is you can contribute to a traditional IRA. Now, people might say, wait a minute, there's some limitations there. The limitation there is contributing to a traditional IRA and deducting it. You can contribute to an IRA and not deduct the contribution at any income level. Bill Gates, as Senior Saulnier next to us likes to say all the time, Bill Gates can contribute to a traditional IRA and not deduct the contribution. Mm-hmm. So you could do that and then turn around, and now that there's no income restriction on converting, you could then convert that money that you just put into your traditional IRA into the Roth and thus effectively get your $5,500, which is the limit for an IRA contribution for someone under the age of 50 in 2016, effectively get your $5,500 into the Roth as if you had contributed it directly.
Yeah.
And that's the loophole. That's the and we call it through the back door, because instead of putting it in obviously directly with a simple contribution, you have to kind of go around the backside and go through the traditional IRA as the first step and then convert into the Roth. And because it's in my opinion, an obvious loophole that they didn't consider fully when they removed the income restriction for Roth conversions back in 2010, I'm surprised actually 7 years later this thing hasn't been slammed shut. But I would chalk it up to the inability for Congress to actually get things done in general.
Yeah.
To the reason why this one,
I can't see any broad-based movement to protect it. I don't see any organized broad-based movement to protect this. So I would have to put this, and thank you, Chris, for that explanation of what the backdoor is. We've covered this on many, many shows because a lot of listeners are using the backdoor to get money into a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. I would have to go out, if I had to say yay or nay, I would say yay. I agree they're going to abolish this, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's in the upcoming tax bill. Just to kind of close this down and keep people from really abusing what was never Congress's intent.
The scary thing for me is how they choose to close the door. What I hope they don't do is just arbitrarily go back to having the income limit on doing a conversion, because that takes away flexibility that people have. Right now,
well, how they did it, the proposal, just so you know, is that pre-tax money is the only money that can be converted, not after-tax money. That's how they'll control
it. That would be the preferred way, because then it attacks just the loophole.
Just controls just the loophole. Because what we're getting at here is, remember Chris said, the strategy is that with a married couple with more than $194,000, and one thing, I don't know if he said it or not because I was reading, you should not have an existing traditional IRA before doing this.
I didn't get into the techniques of making it work.
This is basically a shout out to the other colleagues of ours who listen to us throughout the nation, because some have written to us. And Chris and I do know that. You can't do this if you have another IRA because of the pro rata rule. But let's just assume, without getting into too deep, that the strategy is the couple, whether the husband or wife or both of them, if they're earning more than $194,000 of income, they would contribute to a non-deductible traditional IRA, meaning they're not going to deduct that money on their taxes. First of all, they can't. They probably make too much money.
Well, if they can't, if they can't contribute to a Roth, they're over the limit for
But there are
IRAs.
Some roundabout ways around that. If they're covered or not covered by an employer plan, or if the spouse is doing it, there's some different rules. If the husband, let's say the wife doesn't have a retirement account at work, but the husband does, but they're married, then the earnings can be a certain level for the deduct. It gets a little confusing. So let's just pretend none of that applies here. They would contribute money to a non-deductible IRA. So it's after-tax dollars, folks. They're not deducting it. So if they put $6,500 in each, that's $13,000 of after-tax money. And then they convert it into a Roth IRA. It's 100% tax-free because it's after-tax money already. So they don't have to pay taxes on the conversion. So it kind of works like a contribution. It's just a two-step contribution instead of a one-step. The proposal is to abolish the ability to convert after-tax dollars.
Right.
Where this is going to really cause a problem is in 401ks. Some 401ks have massive amounts of basis, after-tax money in it. There's a lot of employer plans. The only extra contributions you're allowed to put in, especially in older money purchase pension plans and things like that, is after-tax dollars or a 401A. We had questions on that before. So if that happens, you could be faced with a situation where you can't get this basis into a Roth IRA anymore. So not only will it close the back door Roth, it will close the ability to move money from a 401k that's after tax into a Roth IRA.
Now, for those people thinking of it, there most people with a more vanilla style 401k, the money that's in there predominantly, if not all of it, is pre-tax money, which could be converted. But there are cases where, as Jim is describing, where post-tax money can end up in one of these employer-sponsored accounts, like a 401k or the money purchase pension plans of days ago, and those aren't very popular for new folks these days, but those would be barred as well. As they shut this door, they would shut the door on those other
if
things.
They shut it that way.
Yeah.
The other way to shut it is bring back the inability to do conversions.
I think the second as likely proposal for shutting the door here would be to make the rule for conversions have the same income limits as contributions.
That would solve it too. Yeah.
And that
I don't think they would ever bring the converting limits back because that's a revenue killer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they want people. They want the Bill Gateses of
now
the
I'll
world
tell
to
you,
convert.
How about this? How about this for a revenue generator? Bring back the limits but give people 2-year warning. Or 3-year warning. Here it is. It's coming. And so what is everybody going to do? They're going to convert while they can.
Sure they are.
So that would actually entice people. Instead of just leaving the door open, it would try to encourage people to go through the door.
I don't recall seeing this proposal in prior budgets. Are you aware that it's been...
It was in the president's budget.
Oh,
Obama.
Okay, I missed that.
This is the first I've heard of it in the congressional.
Yeah.
I would assume the Democrats put it in there. I mean, I'm not trying to berate them. It just was led by President Obama in his budget proposal for the past 2 years. And he specifically addressed this and said he wants to close this loophole. And like Chris said, this is a loophole.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so I think it could see the light of day. I think Republicans may vote for it, just, you have to do a give and take. So that could be one of the things that they're willing to give up. How they go about doing it, I don't know. But that's one of the reasons I've always told people, get the money in a Roth while you can. A Roth is too good to be true. Mm-hmm. It's 100% tax-free. And someday, I'm not saying anytime soon, it's not in any of these proposals, I could see them just saying no more Roths. They're just too good to be true.
I think what I would see is them imposing income tax on the growth within a Roth. I still think we'll see that at some point in time in the future. Not near, but when they need money, I think that would be an obvious.
That one would be a hard one. It might be beginning at this point forward,
yeah.
Growth is taxed, but they will grandfather people with an IRA up to this day, this Roth IRA will be tax-free?
I don't know. Remember when Social Security wasn't subject to, the receipt of Social Security wasn't subject to income tax, and they chose not to do it that way.
Well, the quick way around that is everybody would just close the Roth IRAs and get the money out tax-free. Mm-hmm. So if they didn't grandfather them, you're just going to see people closing them. Yeah. And I don't want to panic people, because some people have said to me, I'm not putting money in a Roth because I don't believe it. They're going to turn around and tax it. I don't see that. I don't think any politician will be able to say, oh, vote for me. I'm the guy who decided to tax what we told you was tax-free. But I could see them someday saying no more. Mm-hmm. It has to be really grating on their nerves, the amount of tax-free money.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think taxing the growth in the IRA would take enough of the shine off of the IRA to effectively kill it.
Yeah, it would.
Well, it would kill Ross. Why do it?
Exactly. The attractiveness would be gone, and there's a couple other side benefits. There might still be some cases where people find them beneficial, but it would really take the luster.
No, I wouldn't, because number one, now that we're talking about taxes and things, I hate IRAs, because IRAs, you don't get any deduction for capital losses. You don't get any deduction if you lose. Now,
but you don't pay any capital gains.
You don't pay any gains. You pay income taxes. It's worse. Capital gains is better.
Well, but in an investment account, you pay income taxes and capital gains. You paid income tax before it went in, just like a Roth. But then you still get the benefit, in air quotes, you know, the penalty, if you will, of paying capital gains taxes as you move forward. Now, you get to offset some of those gains. You can take some capital losses if you have losing positions in your
account. You also get step up in basis.
That's
you don't get that in mm-hmm. an IRA.
Correct.
An yep. IRA, to me, I can't mm-hmm. stand IRAs, because you don't get to deduct losses. You don't get a step up in basis. You have to pay income taxes. You don't get the mm-hmm. benefits. You get all of the risk of investing. The reason why investments get these special treatments, step up in basis, capital gains treatment, capital loss treatment, is because you are taking a risk with your money. Inside an IRA, you are taking that same risk, and you get none of the benefits. So I really am not a fan of people putting money into an IRA. When Roth IRAs came out, I loved them right away, because here was a case where you weren't technically getting all of the benefits of investment risk, but you were getting a lot of them, and the ones you were getting were even better, 100% tax-free. Now, you couldn't deduct the losses, but you would get the benefit of the gains being tax-free, and in other words, rewarded for putting your capital at risk. And people aren't factoring that in. The only reason I recommend 401ks is the match. If there's no match, I'm not a fan of 401ks either. Now, granted, if you're a professional, you're worried about being sued, Pete, you would agree 401ks give you better creditor and bankruptcy protections.
Yeah, they do.
So there's some of these accounts, people do pay a lot of attention to the tax ramifications of these, and you always have to remember these accounts, particularly Roths, are always forgotten, these side benefits. There are many side benefits, as you just mentioned, with the creditor protection on retirement accounts that you can't easily get outside of that realm. It costs money, essentially, to put money in a place.
Yeah, you got to hire people like Pete to create trusts.
To create trusts and things like that.
That's why Pete's sitting there saying,
I don't, I mean, you're talking about it like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Paying people like you?
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to.
So okay. I do agree. To sum up, I guess, the loophole of the backdoor Roth probably going to go away sooner than later. As far as just Roths themselves being attacked fundamentally, I think we're still a ways off from that, but it still might. Again, they're pretty sweet. Yeah. I mean, they're pretty, have a lot of benefits, the obvious tax benefit, and then they have a lot of lesser known side benefits that we try to discuss a lot, that so many people, and I would put this on these air quote calculators on the internet. They talk about, you know, compare your Roth contributions to a traditional IRA to 401k. All that it considers are the tax differences. it doesn't take into consideration all the side benefits, like no RMDs, so you can control when they come out, the income, the distributions from the Roth not being counted in order to calculate whether your Social Security is subject to taxes. It doesn't count to push you into a higher adjusted gross income level where your Medicare premiums go up. There's all these side benefits that aren't included in any of those calculators. So to understand the full story of these, I agree with Jim. The Roths have a lot of advantages beyond just the tax situation. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get to another one while we're running out of time. This one I like to call the Mitt Romney provision. It's been in the congressional budget since the 08 election, and the rumor that Mitt Romney had between, what, $2 million and $120 million in an IRA. Nobody really knew, and Mitt never said. Mm-hmm. But he had a hell of a lot of money in an IRA. So they want to impose maximum IRA funding limits. This has been in the president's proposal for many, many years, since 09, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. So it's been in there for, not since 09. When was the Mitt Romney election? 2012. Mm-hmm. So this would have been in 13, 14, 15. So the past 4 years, at least, in the president's budget proposal. The article I'm reading claims it was in congressional budget proposals for 6 years. I don't think so. And I'm not saying this gentleman who seems much smarter than me who wrote it.
I think the rumors of people having huge amounts in their IRAs occurred before Romney. Romney was just the first public figure that everyone knew that happened to have this rumor attached to them. So I remember hearing about it before, not a lot, but then it really exploded in the rumor mill when Romney was running for president. So.
And what this proposal is, and I would give this very scant chance of passage, especially in this Congress that's coming up beginning in 2017. What they want to do is arbitrarily come up with a number. The number being banted around is 3.4 million. And say any IRA bigger than that is not needed to live a comfortable retirement, and you can no longer let your IRA get above that. I don't see.
So they'd effectively change the RMD rules and force you to take distributions.
Well, the president
out.
Did it a different way. His proposal limited the amount that could be in an IRA based on how much it would take to buy an annuity payment equal to, and he came up with a number. I forgot how. It was, well, I thought it was 200-something thousand, Pete.
200,000 is what I recall.
Oh, it was the 208 number that's the maximum you can have from an employer-sponsored plan, a qualified plan.
Yes.
Yeah, it was that same number. That's
so
he used
that number and said, look, your IRA can never be bigger than what it would take to buy an annuity to pay you this much. His proposal, although might have been the most fair
and logical,
would be a nightmare to track.
A practical nightmare.
Because it is going to be based on current interest rates and it would change daily. I mean, it's nuts. But I got to give the man credit. It would have been the fairest than just coming up with some arbitrary number. That's why I don't think this is going to see the light of day. And it also will be really... I read an article once that there's less than 1,000 IRAs in the United States that would be subject to this. I mean, it's not a big number. And it's just really at that point just trying to go after quote-unquote rich. I mean, it's not a revenue generator because it's not going to force any money out. It's just going to stop the money going in. It's just, to me, un-American. It's just we're jealous.
Yeah.
I don't think this is going to see the light of day. But I was interested in this guy's article when he said it's been in proposed budget documents for the past 6 years. I didn't realize it's been in that long because it gained traction in our industry when Obama put it in there and he made it perfectly clear it was because of Mitt Romney. He didn't hide from that. And he started putting it in his budget proposal. As you said, the president comes out with theirs, Congress comes out with theirs, then they negotiate, and the rest is the sausage. But that's a saying.
I know.
Mm-hmm. What are you laughing for? Because he didn't laugh. You laughed this time.
Yeah, I did. I just have never heard that expression used in that manner.
No, I think it's. I think it fits pretty well.
Yeah, it does.
You grind up all this.
Yeah, and out comes the sausage.
Nastiness,
yeah,
and it becomes
so
the.
You know what? What was it? Mark Twain or Will Rogers said that watching Congress in session pass laws and so kind of
watching the butcher make sausage.
Yeah, that's
what I was saying.
Yeah, you're very Mark Twainish there.
All right. Yes. Well, it's not often my best friend laughs at me.
Well, I just hadn't heard it used in that context. So, but you're being creative.
And my second best friend didn't laugh.
Yours is best friend.
Apparently.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that did
you? We learn all kinds of things on this
I'm glad
show.
I came in today.
Well, I should be your best friend if I'm beneficiary of your IRA.
Pushing for that beneficiary change.
I got to go home tonight. It may not last very long.
Yeah, best friends, temporary.
Just change me to beneficiary before going home.
How about instead of BFF best friends forever, you're the BBF best beneficiary forever.
There you go.
I'll be the BBF. Pete's BBF. All right, how much time do we have?
We have about a minute and a half, so we can't start another one yet until the next, unless you want to give people a teaser.
The teaser is, you've never heard this before, repeal net unrealized appreciation.
Oh, wow. You left a...
This is a mouthful.
The proverbial turd in the punch bowl.
Right? Can you say that on the radio?
I just did. We'll hear about it.
Yeah, this one is going to go over...
like a lead balloon.
Like a lead balloon.
Wow. There you go.
I've never heard a radio show where that phrase has been uttered more frequently than this one here.
Like a lead balloon?
Yeah, that's like the fifth time that's been said.
You can't go over... lead balloons don't float. Get it?
Duh. You're explaining an American saying to us?
At least my saying.
Okay. No. Yeah, balloon.
You're just touting your own horn there.
You're touting your own horn. So, well, let's not beat that horse to death.
See, all my Americanisms are rubbing off on you.
Yeah, they're rubbing somewhere. So... after this next break, we're going to hear the number one song. Actually, again, we're not going to hear the number one song. We're going to play the number three hit from 1981 this week from a band formerly known as Strontium 90.
Wow.
Which was
an
invention just kind of like bikini, right? It was a phrase that came out because of the popularity of the atom bomb at the time. So Strontium 90 is one of the radioactive isotopes generated from nuclear fission.
Wow. So, I'm impressed.
And is this the band or the song?
The band used to be called Strontium 90. So we'll find out who that is after the short break.
Gotcha.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Very recognizable voice there, and Sting, lead singer for The Police, formerly known as Strontium 90. That's one I didn't know.
Oh, they made a good choice there, changing that name.
I thought so, too. So that's Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic. Sting wrote the song all the way back in 1977 as a demo, but his bandmates thought it was a bit soft for the type of music they wanted to do. They also resented the use of a piano in the background. That's kind of harsh against pianos, actually resenting the piano.
Yeah, I know.
But Sting brought it up again in 1981, and they still resisted him, but they agreed just to appease him to record a demo tape just to show him that it was, would be terrible.
Yeah.
And then they listened to it, and they liked it, and number three.
Wow.
Number three, one of the most recognizable songs from The Police, so... That's
very good.
And we do all this as our lead in to what's new on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, which is our blog
But once again, that is helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. We've got a new post almost every week, this week being an exception.
Apparently, why don't you have a post this week?
Well, you know, this is, you know, the time of holidays and finals at school, and it's been a little busy. So I might come up with a new one, I might not. However, I'm going to go ahead and play the song real quick.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
Because I did want to discuss something that is fairly new.
The email question?
An email that came in, a new email that came in referring to a recent blog post. So would you like me to cover this now, or would you like to... I would prefer to cover this and hopefully run out of time before we have to talk about net unrealized.
Well, we have one more after net unrealized appreciation, too, to talk about, to get through all six.
Oh. Well, I'll hurry then. So I got this email.
You don't have to overly hurry, because NUA isn't going to take as long.
Thank goodness. So I received an email. We at the office received the email. It was forwarded to me asking a question about when someone can file for spousal benefits after they're freshly married. The normal rule, and the rule most people are familiar with, is you have to be married for 1 year before you can qualify for receiving spousal benefits on your spouse's work record. A few other things have to take place, such as that spouse must file for their own benefit themselves in order to do that. But even if they do that immediately upon marriage, traditionally you have to have waited the full year. But there are exceptions to that. And one of the exceptions I wrote about in a previous blog post from, I don't know, I'd have to look back. It's been in the past couple of months, though.
It was sunny and warm.
So it might have been September then. So it was a little while ago, but it's fairly recently that we clarified through the Social Security Code and the POMS, the Procedural Operations Manual that the Social Security is supposed to follow, that an exception to the one-year rule is, and there's a couple, I'm going to focus on this one, and the one is if the spouse was either entitled or potentially entitled to some auxiliary benefit from a previous number holder, is what they call it. So a previous
meaning
spouse,
person
yeah, that has paid into Social Security, the 1 year wait does not apply. Hmm. So what that means essentially is, let's say someone was married and was collecting a spousal benefit, became divorced, and then remarried. Because they're receiving a spousal...
Hitched their horse to a new cart.
Hitched their cart to a new horse. The horse is the number holder. It's backwards again.
Whatever.
Okay. You and get remarried. The remarriage, in order to claim a spousal on that person's record, normally, under the rule, you'd have to wait a year. But it also shuts off. You've disconnected your cart from the old horse, your old spouse, and that spousal benefit, and now you're connected to a new horse. But without this exception, you now would have to go without a benefit for a year. So this rule is in place so that if you're already collecting a spousal benefit from an old spouse, and then you move to a new spouse, you can start collecting a new spousal immediately from that new spouse. But you notice when I worded it, it was entitled. Mm-hmm. Which would be the example where you're actually collecting from the old spouse and then go to the new spouse. But the wording is entitled or potentially entitled, and that's the key. Potentially entitled means you would be entitled to a benefit for all reasons except you hadn't yet filed. You hadn't taken that last step of going in and turning it on. But in all other ways, you were entitled to receive that spousal or survivor benefit from a previous relationship. And this, and I wrote about this, because this was very interesting to people, that they could bypass this 1 year wait as long as your new spouse was potentially entitled in the month prior to the new marriage to receive a benefit from another spouse from before, whether it's a spousal benefit or a survivor benefit. Well, the person who wrote me said they'd been into Social Security and had been told that the new spouse, would have to wait a year, even though that spouse was clearly potentially entitled to a spousal benefit from a divorce that had previously happened.
And I think they were married for 20 years.
And that previous marriage had happened for 20 years. So,
and he was 66.
And he was six. There was all these reasons that clearly made it so that they were potentially entitled in the month before the marriage.
They just hadn't turned it on. Hadn't, but he could have.
But he could have. And because of the wording in the rule that all you have to be is potentially entitled, that person absolutely should be entitled to receive a spousal benefit from this new marriage immediately without the 1 year wait. So I wrote him back and gave to him the reference in the operations manual.
And we're waiting to hear back when he goes with all that.
And suggested he goes back with a copy of this to the Social Security Administration office and escalate this, if he still receives the same resistance, escalate it to what's called a technical expert, which is someone who's supposed to know even more than the frontline people, or to a manager in the office. And he should receive the answer he's looking for, which is there is no delay on that. I will keep people updated. If he receives some more pushback, I will have to reach out through some multiple steps to get a hold of some Social Security people to find out why, in fact, they are not following the rule, because the rule is very clear when you read it. But if there is an update to this, or if they have changed the rule without proper notification, which is always possible, we are dealing with the government here, and if the POMS has been updated, but they haven't made it publicly available, there might be some change of which we're not aware. But as of today, when I went to the manual online, which should be up to date, it clearly states what I have mentioned.
Yep, it's one of those obscure little rules. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't surprise me that the first person they ran into in the Social Security office didn't know anything about it. We're not downplaying the important role those people play, but they're not Social Security experts.
Well, if you're familiar with the King James version of the Bible and its thickness, the palms is thicker.
Exactly.
So it is. It's a little hard to master everything.
And,
that's
right.
In it.
And that's where this technical expert is supposed to come into play. Every office has one. They're kind of like me in this office. So...
Oh, sorry, I was just cleaning my... It's cold season, so...
I wouldn't be the technical expert of the office?
Well, on some things. You
know. Like, not on Social Security.
Like, where did my leftover meatloaf go in the refrigerator?
I freely admit Chris is the go-to expert on Social Security. Pete, you're the go-to expert on estate planning. And me, I just know where used meatloaf is. So, excellent.
Yeah, so that's we'll consider that this week's update on what's new on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. What's new,
pussycat? Oh, okay.
That was quick.
All right. So let's get back to the last two proposals. There are six. We've gone over four.
14 minutes to achieve
this. No problem. So one of the proposals is to abolish net unrealized appreciation rules. This one, I'm going to probably surprise you, Pete. I think this one could see the light of day only because nobody knows what the hell it is.
I want to kill it because it's so complicated.
Agreed.
People could get rid of it and no one would even know.
Right.
Because it impacts people, as Chris said, not it's complicated, but not many people even know it exists. Unfortunately... many advisors don't even know it exists. And those who do know it exists don't know the rules on how to do it right. And they screw it up all the time. But in short, if you have employer stock in a 401k, and that stock has very low basis, basis is the value of the stock when it went put into your 401k. If you have very low basis, if your basis is $5 and the stock is now $50 and you retire, there is a special rule called net unrealized appreciation that you could utilize to get money out of the 401k without significant income taxation. So getting rid of this rule would be a revenue generator. It would also simplify the tax code because it's just one of these obscure rules. So I wouldn't be surprised if it happened.
I wonder how many people... every year actually are doing an NUA calculation for their distributions.
Yeah, I know a lot of advice, because Ed covers this ad nauseum. This is where I've learned everything about it. I could talk the whole show on NUA. I know a lot about NUA. And it's only because Ed has drilled it into our heads. There are many people I met in Ed's group. Most of them work around big areas like Boeing, Microsoft, Exxon down in Louisiana. There was one guy in Louisiana who's made a killing off of helping Exxon employees understand NUA. So if you happen to be an advisor based around one of these employers that put stock in employer 401ks, they are very knowledgeable on these, and they'll sit there and say they do these till the cows come home, and they hope they don't get rid of it. Second nature to them. Mm-hmm. I've been in business for 17 years and had a whopping one person ever be eligible for NUA. And then when I explained it to them and they looked at me, they went, huh? And they just moved the money. They didn't do the NUA.
Yeah.
But I don't see it often. We don't have that type of employer base here in our section of Colorado. But there are parts of the country, Chris, where there are advisors in the Ed Slot group who do this all the time. And that's why Ed goes over it so much. So it is a very good strategy. I'm not getting into it because I'm not kidding, folks. I could do a whole two-hour show on NUA. If we have nothing to do.
But it specifically, for those of you, if you do not have employer stock, the stock from the company that is sponsoring the
right,
the
it can't be any
plan.
Stock. You can't right. be working for Microsoft right. and be holding Apple stock in right. your 401k. And, it won't work.
And it's
and you'll probably get fired.
The stocks, they weren't stocks in that company that you happen to buy from within it, which usually probably doesn't happen in the 401k anyway. Like you could in an IRA, you could work for Boeing and buy Boeing stock in your IRA. No NUA situation. It's when those stock shares were awarded to you as compensation, essentially, into the 401k. That's when this
I believe also, though, Chris, you can do it by buying. I have clients who are working, say, for Kroger right now, and they're buying Kroger stock. So it applies to even stock
you
purchase.
Oh, you know what? I take it back. You're right. You can use it at times when you've actually purchased it
yes.
instead of it being awarded.
Yes.
It has to be in one of these retirement
You have
accounts,
to
though.
Keep track of the basis, and the employer generally keeps track of the basis of awarded stock. They will always have the basis in there. And the basis is essentially the value on the stock on the day they gave it to you. There is a value that they have to declare. So they'll give you that basis. Now, if it's stock you purchased, the 401k itself is probably tracking that for you. But again, it begins and it only works with low basis, folks. If you have stock in your 401k, if you're thinking, oh my God, Jim knows something, I should get a hold of him. I don't mind you getting a hold of me if you think you are eligible for NUA, I can help you with it. But if you're sitting there with stock that you paid 30 for and now it's worth 20, it ain't going to work for you. Don't even call me. But it has to. The stock has to be worth more than what you paid. And truly, folks, for the pain in the hiney that it is, it has to be significantly greater. You got to have paid $5 and it's now worth $20. But if you paid $5 and it's now worth $6 or $7.50, it's probably not going to be worth it for you to try to figure it all out. But it can be done. There's a bunch of steps to it. But what it does do, and especially the Louisiana guy for Exxon, I chatted with him quite a lot. He taught me a lot on NUA, and it saves his clients a lot of money.
It reduces the tax burden
oh, absolutely.
On the
absolutely.
Distributions from that account.
But there's some negatives to it. You don't get a step up in basis on the NUA amount. I mean, I'm getting a little deep into the mud here. But there's some negatives to it, but there's also some positives to it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to bother explaining the strategy, but if you are someone listening and you have employer stock in your 401k, and your basis in the stock is very low, and the employer stock is significantly higher, and you're retiring, you may want to consider NUA before they get rid of it, and just get a hold of me, and I'll explain to you what in the hell all this means. But if they do abolish this, if they do bring this up in the current proposal, I don't think... Even though it wouldn't surprise me if it passes, I don't think it would. I don't think the coming Congress, being run by Republicans, are going to get rid of this. I just don't.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to continue, people, so don't worry. So what is the last one? The last one is not a revenue gatherer. In my opinion, the previous five We're all revenue gatherers. Eliminate the stretch IRA for non-spouse beneficiaries. Revenue gatherer, Pete, yes or no?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Eliminate backdoor Roth IRAs. Easily, that could be a revenue gatherer if you understand how it works. Imposing required minimum distribution on Roth IRAs. No, will not generate revenue because it's going to be removed tax-free.
Not directly.
But the theory is it'll help the economy, and they're going to have to take it out of the Roth and reinvest it, and now they can tax that.
Right. So it'll be out of the tax protection of the Roth now, so could possibly expose it to taxes in the future.
Repeal at net unrealized appreciation, absolutely a revenue gatherer if you understand how NUA works. Absolutely. Impose maximum funding on IRAs, not a revenue gatherer, just a we hate rich people rule. So it brings us to the one thing here that really can apply to middle class and lower middle class people, but it's kind of like asking a drowning man if he wants any water. I don't think anyone's ever going to use it. It is to eliminate required minimum distributions on any IRA with less than $100,000 in assets. This has wide support, but the unfortunate thing is most people who have just $100,000 in their IRA need the distributions.
Right. They're going to take it anyway.
The people who won't will probably be government employees and union employees and old-time pension employees who have a wonderful pension and really don't need the money from the IRA. But that's not who this rule is supposed to help. But I have many clients who have less than 100,000. We don't have account minimums, folks, in our office. I'm a financial planner. We're not just an investment advisor. So we don't have account minimums. So we work with people who want advice and need help. So I have people with less than 100,000, Chris, in IRAs, which may surprise a lot of our colleagues who are listening who impose these account minimums. You've known me for years, Pete. Mm-hmm. I work with everyone.
Yeah.
And I've never imposed minimums, and I don't care. My price is the same, whether you have $1 million or $100,000. You want a financial plan or a retirement plan, we're going to charge you the same. As long as you pay for us, we're going to give you our service, Chris. But I can tell you, those clients of ours who have less than $100,000, I have several who are government retirees, military retirees, pension retirees. They're going to love this because they're being forced to take money out that they don't need. Mm-hmm.
Because they're living on the pension.
But the people who don't have that, Pete, who have just less than $100,000, they need every red cent we can get out of it.
Oh, sure.
So I think the rule is interesting, but it's not going to be used, and President Obama was the one who first proposed this, it's not going to be used in the way he thinks it's going to. He thinks he's helping people who have less than $100,000 in an IRA. Oh, I'm going to help them. I'm not going to force them to take any money out. They need the money. Of course they're going to take it out.
Well, I think it does. Any of these rules, I agree it doesn't help as many people as they are targeting or thinking that it might help. But any of these rules that release, undo the handcuffs, the restrictions and the controls that the government forces you in with these accounts, you never know someone's personal situation. And giving them the freedom to choose, yes, I want to take it out this year. No, I don't want to take it out this year because of other events. Because it isn't all your, and we're talking about your tax situation here primarily. Your tax situation can vary from year to year. Maybe you receive some one-time distribution for something, or who knows, from year to year. Maybe you work 1 year, have a part-time job, but then the next year you don't. It would be really nice to have the flexibility as much as possible to choose when to take money out or not to take the money out based on your personal situation. These arbitrary RMDs take that away from people. It handcuffs them and restricts them to that minimum amount. Now, if you're taking out, you need to live on it, and you're taking more out than the RMDs anyway, these RMD rules don't affect you. But there are many, many people that in any given year, given the choice to take money out or not, wouldn't unless they had to.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have these real simplistic blanket rules that cover everyone without harming those that need the flexibility to choose, take more out in this year, less in another year.
But I also think it's arbitrary and capricious, $100,000. Why not 150 or two? I mean, just where do you come up with this? Get rid of RMDs, period, which they'll never do. But it just, again, I honestly think this would probably pass only because it just appeals to politicians. Oh, we helped people retire better and save their money. So I could see this one seeing the light of day, but hey,
I'm coming up with, just off the cuff, I would say maybe a good compromise would be that your IRA needs to be taxed by the time you die. When you take it out is up to you, but if you leave a big chunk there when you pass away,
it's all going to be taxed.
It's all going to be taxed that year at whatever it is on your final income tax return. But it gives then people the flexibility. If they're worried about having a big amount left at the end, take some out. Take enough out so that by the time you get
And a lot
enough,
of people say, ah, screw it. The person who inherits it will have to deal with it.
Yeah, but then they're living, they maintain don't have to, yep. the flexibility, but the government still will get all their tax money by the time the person passes away.
Well, isn't that essentially the effect of the first proposal, eliminating
the stretch IRA? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it keeps the minimum in and gets the account closed quicker. How much time do we have?
Minute and a half.
Damn. I got a quick question that a colleague just sent me, and I think you might be able to eat it. Jim, not eat it, read it. Not read it, answer it.
It's a
whatever
lot
the
of
hell.
Confidence.
Let me talk, will you? All right. Jim, do you know anything about Medicaid? No, but Pete does. Okay. I had a client who we used to call the starving artist. She came in yesterday, and she inherited a home from her mother, who died in 2010. The home is located in Toronto and is worth $350,000 in capital gains. It will become income to my client. They're going to sell it.
Okay.
She was receiving rent from the home but made so little in rent, she is on Medicaid and has a lot of health problems. We are now trying to decide if the sale will kick her off Medicaid or not. If so, will it just kick her off a year and then she can get back on?
My understanding is it will kick her off until she has her countable resources, that is the proceeds, down to $2,000 and added with everything else she has.
So if she's going to inherit $350,000, it's not only going to kick her off for a year, it could kick her off until her countable assets are down to $2,000.
Yeah, it kicks her off until she's spent that.
So that music means we're at the end of another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. We might expand upon this question in a future show, but we have come to the end today. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with another brand new show. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you later.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.